call the Health and Human Services Committee to order, please. And we are going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 818. Would you please read the description, summary of the bill?
Thank you, Senator. In front of you is Senate Bill 818. We do have the Dash 1 amendments, which basically replaces the bill. What the Dash 1 amendments do is to require the Department of Human Services to administer a pilot program ongoing. Requires Department of Human Services to administer the pilot, this program established under the original 2003 Oregon laws that originated the first bill, faith-based program. And then report, requires DHS to report biannually to the Legislative Assembly on this program, and then repeals this section in January 2012. There's also a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on this bill. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Andrea Morgan, would you please? Senator Shields? Okay. Andrea Morgan, would you please come up?
Andrea Morgan. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm here today to continue to express our concerns in hopes that we can continue discussing this bill a little bit more to get us to a place where we will be able to move forward and address the ACLU concerns. I've had a chance to review the Dash 1 amendments, which alter the bill from the original 818 in terms of putting the sunset till 2012. Our concerns are that the program would allow a pilot program, but it would be statewide. And it could be any and all jurisdictions. And it would also not expire until 2012. What I testified to originally was the need, first of all, for us to have a report as to a complete assessment of the pilot project that has transpired over the last 2 years. The interim committee report, which is not the report, raised a number of concerns by DHS about questions they had, methodologies they still needed to determine, and analysis that hadn't happened. And we were eagerly awaiting that and still are. So we think there needs to be that report. We would encourage that this be a continued two-year pilot, limited to a particular jurisdiction, with the requirement that there be another report to the legislature 2 years from now, so we can see our concerns may be unfounded. The program may be unnecessary or may be necessary. It's a lot of questions we want to find out. If our concerns are unfounded, that makes us a lot more comfortable. I think it would make the senator and all the members of this body much more comfortable. If it's effective, it's a good use of money within the agency. If it's not effective, because as I've testified before and I know others have in the past, there is a lot of collaboration with faith-based organizations, and those can and must continue and do, regardless of this. So we need to see how this particular niche is really working. And so I would urge this committee to allow us to have a little bit more discussion, do a two-year pilot, get the report for this session, and determine how well it's going before we move to a statewide plan. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, I remained open, and ACLU remains committed to trying to get to some resolution on this bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Andrea.
Senator Cruz.
If for some strange reason this bill moved today, I'm assuming you would be able to continue your discussion on the House side. Would that be a correct assumption?
Chair Morris said the ACLU always remains eager to continue a conversation, but I'm concerned that with momentum and a feeling that this body has vetted and approved that version, that they'd be less inclined to kind of revisit things that have been discussed and could be perceived as rejected over here. And unfortunately, the ACLU not wanting to be would probably be in a posture with this bill in this version. We cannot support it, and we can't even be neutral on the current Dash 1 amendments. It just causes us too many concerns and questions, and And I do hope that we could get to a place where the ACLU could just be neutral on the matter.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Ellen Lowe, would you please come up?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Ellen Lowe, and I appear today as legislative advocate for the Oregon Law Center. I am not here on their behalf to oppose or support the bill, but to actually seek additional information. We very much would like to see an update of the report that where there was an interim one that was done, I believe, last November, but we have been told that is not the final report. And we do believe that the current legislation asks that that be forthcoming to you so you can make judgments. And we would like to review it, too, to make sure that the process and the evaluation of the pilot is gives us assurance that what is being done expands access rather than limits it. And so we encourage you to hold this over and to seek additional information from the department. We also would ask that as you look at changes to 818, when indeed that report comes back to you, that you would look at the kinds of things that need to be evaluated so indeed there can be some real accountability. This is an area where it's extremely important that we allow functional interaction, but that we do not go through that veil of separation. And so, again, we ask that you seek additional information from the department in terms of their analysis, and that you look at a way, particularly because evidently this did not get underway quickly, that any future work again be limited in scope so there can be additional analysis for the next step as well. And I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. Questions. Did you hear a report in, you said, September? Were you present at a meeting when a report was made?
I have seen a copy of some preliminary information that was put together, I believe it was in November. But I have been told that the report was never finalized. Okay. And so if that is in process, I don't know. But it's just, there were some questions raised then, and so we look to you to assist us in being able to analyze whether or not access really was enhanced by this program.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, Senator Shields and Director Weeks, would you come up, please?
Okay.
The issue of the report has been raised, and would you like to respond to that, Director Weeks, please?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. For the record, I'm Gary Weeks, Director of the Department of Human Services. Appreciate the opportunity to be here with Senator Shields to talk with you about this bill. The report that Ellen Lowe has referred to isn't really a report, as I understand it. I mean, we prepared something for Senator Shields that was very early in this process. Remember, this bill didn't come, this charge wasn't effective till January of 2004. And from that point, we began to try to figure out what kind of training the staff had to have in Coos County. We had to develop some way to keep track of people that were referred and who they referred to and so on. So the actual real work didn't get going for several months. And so it was pretty premature in September, October, November to give a report, and shouldn't be considered to be what I would view as a report to you or to Senator Shields or to anyone else, because it was just a preliminary view of where we were on this project. And as Richard Whitworth testified the last time we talked about this bill, there are a number of things that still are in development of this. It's a new program. It's a sort of a new direction for us, and I think we all ought to recognize and admit that this program needs to be worked for a while till we really see whether, you know, there's the value there. The number of people that took us up on the option to for a referral to a community organization or a faith-based organization wasn't large. I mean, I think you'll remember that by the data. Those that did found some extreme benefit to it. And this bill, as amended now, doesn't say we're going to do a statewide program. It says that the department will expand, basically, within the resources that it has. And so it has no fiscal, just as the original bill had no fiscal. There was no appropriation in 2003 for the department to do this. We were asked to do this pilot within the budget. And we're now asked, in this amended bill, to continue that pilot and, if possible, to expand on it. And as we continue to do this work, we're going to get more data and better data, and we'll have outcomes that I think you can hang your hat on a little bit more down the road. The amended bill says that we will bring to you each biennium a report on this program, and I would guess the report would talk about things that Richard mentioned before, and that is, how many referrals did we have to either community or faith-based organizations? What were the results of those referrals? How long did people, you know, stick with it? Did the clients find that there was a benefit? So it'd be a self-reporting whether there was a benefit to their referral. And we'll begin to develop more and better information for you each biennium. When this report is brought to you, I would offer that if you feel there's more that needs to be followed up on, then the legislature can easily direct the department and say, well, now, before this next report comes in, here's what we would like to know about the client population. Because right now, we're breaking in a new program, trying to figure out what's the best information to give to you that would be the kind of evaluative information you would say, you'd be able to say whether this program has good outcomes or not. So we think with the amendments, and we've worked with Senator Shields to bring these amendments about, it makes it a little bit more workable for us. We think that it's a program that's worthy of looking at expansion. I would say to you, there's not a possibility to take this program statewide within the budget we have. We're going to gradually grow this program, and we're going to gradually learn how to run it well and whether it really does have good outcomes, and I think that's the opportunity we have here.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
Hey, Gary, I guess the way I look at it, I don't see necessarily a downside if we're connecting people to services that the state isn't having to pay for necessarily. That's a positive thing. And you say you're not going to roll it out statewide, so the way I would see it playing out would be one of your local people sees the connection and will have the ability to make that connection for a client. And I can also see how these numbers would be hard to get because you're also connecting to services that maybe you can't put a price tag on necessarily. So, this dash one really doesn't change what exists. It just gives you the ability to look other places, I think, doesn't it?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cruz, that's absolutely correct. It gives us the ability to move the program, broaden it, within the budget that we have, and within our ability to really learn from it, to be able to collect good data. I mean, I'm with the chair and others that to say in saying that, you know, we need to bring you as accurate of information as we can to see if this really makes a difference. But as I said in my testimony the last time we did this, we heard this bill, We have long and historic relationships with faith-based organizations. And those relationships today have much more intimate connection between the client and the service deliverer, which is a faith-based organization, than what we're talking about here. We're talking about a referral system here, where our staff asks questions as, you know, are you with the church? Are you interested in any information about a community organization in Coos Bay? Or are you interested in connecting with some faith that you may have been part of before you came to our community? If so, here's the address. Here's who you communicate with. That's it. We're not driving people, you know, to Mass or anything else like that. So I think it's an opportunity to test whether or not these connections that people have, individuals, families, have historically had in other communities, whether those connections can be sustained in a new community and help them and their families, you know, develop. So,
Senator Stark.
Yes, Senate Chair Marcet, Gary, and Frank. In our delivery of services to clients throughout the state, how do we work with county folks in our delivery?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, the county governments are very important to our delivery service because it's through contracts with the counties that we deliver mental health services, alcohol and drug treatment services, public health services. All of those are county-based services. So we contract with county organizations who may in turn contract with their local nonprofit providers for those. But the county is a major partner for us, Senator.
Follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
Washington County has developed what they call the faith-based initiative as a county.
Mm-hmm.
And they're delivering those very services that you're talking about in many different ways. But drug and alcohol treatment by faith-based organizations is very common.
Yes.
And I think that you're absolutely correct in that we already have a very important connection with that community. But I think as we are able to draw that community together, regardless of denomination, or that there are many assets there that are forthcoming that will help us in tutoring children or a variety of issues that we have to deal with. And so I think this is one way of just bringing a little more light on the opportunity we have to expand services to those people we're trying to serve. I appreciate your comments.
Okay, thank you. I have some concerns, I guess. I don't know if they've been addressed or not. It seems to me that the current law requires a report. The law that we passed last time said you shall make a report to the next biennium. Now, did we or did we not get a report is the question.
I want to respond to that, Senator Morissette.
For the record.
Right. For the record, I'm Frank Shields, I think. This is the first time I've been in public since last week. And I'm under the direction of a cardiologist and my wife sitting behind me to make darn sure I don't get excited about anything. So I'm not excited about this bill. I'm on record as not being excited.
Okay, good. We have that clear. You're being seated when you talk.
Yes, and I'm not waving my hand.
Don't wave your arms either.
No, I'm not doing any of the above. If we had established a pilot project maybe in Oregon City or in Multnomah County or out in Hillsborough or someplace, I might have been more on top of this than I was. But the group that came forward that had the most interesting relationship and positive and already built relationship between the faith community and the local DSH was Delivery Area 7 in Coos Bay. So this thing began on its own and moved at its own pace. They took most of 2004 to try to learn one another's languages and to train the Department of Human Services how to speak some God language and hopefully some churches how to speak legalese. That happened. There was this give and take back and forth. The project after training, and I went to Coos Bay two or three times, the project after training actually started gathering data and actually started sharing with people the possibility that if they wanted, they could reconnect with their historic faith or community-based organization. That didn't start until October, September-October window. And they gathered data just for 1 month. It's like putting your toe in the water, trying to get a feel for how to do this. So there was no report made then at all. And I kind of wish that I hadn't asked Richard Whitwer to give me some stuff in writing, because that stuff has been duplicated and has been referred to as a report. It wasn't a biennial report. It was just preliminary information that I asked for. As I understand it, we have from now till the end of the biennium to get the report together. And I'll be glad to deliver it to you at that time. But they have more information now than they had when they made the report to me. I wanted that information just to find out how people were reacting. And when I found out, I really did learn that the reason that so few people took us up on our offer of help was kind of the approach that we took. We changed the landscape. These were people who'd been coming through the door, and all of a sudden there was a new question. And I think it was a confusing question. So we went back and retooled and decided, let's not do it with already existing clientele, but let's do it with new clientele that come through the door for the first time that have a crisis, and to better help those people after they've been determined to be eligible for food stamps or for the welfare check or whatever. Hey, do you have a connection with a faith-based or a community-based organization? Might that be of some help to you? Those kinds of questions. I don't have the questions in front of me precisely, but the reality is that when we were developing this bill years ago and its predecessor studies, we talked with the Oregon Law Commission, the ACLU, various faith and community-based organizations, various religions, various denominations. I tried to have a bill that was very different from what I see at the national level. Both the Clinton and Bush administrations have charitable choice options where people actually go chasing money and you get federal grant dollars. In this bill, the idea was that all the money should stay with the state, and what we would do was to build bridges to help people. And I think if the idea, the dream ever catches on, we can deliver services better, more comprehensively, we can help more people, and save some tax dollars in the process of doing it. I'd like to remind everybody that on the first page of the bill down in line 23, it says a client's affiliation with faith-based and community-based organizations may not adversely impact a client's eligibility for department services. And then the next sentence, the department may not require the client to participate in activities or services of a faith-based or community-based organization. I mean, there's restrictions built in all over the place. Nobody's going to get carried away. The effect of this is the Dash 1 amendments keep the program as a pilot based in Coos Bay. In line 25 on page 1, by amending the language to read that DHS shall establish and administer the pilot, it allows them to expand it within existing budget as is practicable. It's not going to go statewide. Well, hey, what if they find ways of delivering services better and more comprehensive down there? Wouldn't you like them to try it a few other places? Develop it, let it grow slowly. The amendments in Section 2 make it clear that this pilot is to be administered within legislatively approved budget. It shouldn't have a referral to Ways and Means. Nothing in Coos Bay was outside of the budget. I drove down there and back a couple times, never asked for a penny for more than 1,000 miles of driving. You know, others are doing the same thing. It's a collaboration between DHS and lots of community-based people that aren't asking for money, lots of faith-based people that aren't asking for money. Section 2, sub 2, amends the pilot so that DHS reports back biennially to the legislature. That's accountability for you. If you as the legislature have any questions or any input, you've got a golden opportunity after each report that comes to you from DHS. You can tweak it, you can change it. The sunset on the pilot is 2012. That means you got two or three or four opportunities, starting with the report that we'll give you by the end of this biennium, to say, hey, why don't you do this? Why don't you add this? Why don't you subtract that? The idea here is to follow a dream, to try to deliver services to poor people in ever-shrinking budgets, to do it more efficiently and with more community partners.
Thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 818.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 818.
Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 818. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, so moved.
Mr. Chair, I...
Okay, let me say something now. Okay. Any discussion, any further discussion? I've spent a lot of time over the last 30 years actually working with faith-based organizations. As Mayor of Springfield for 10 years I worked with faith-based St. Vincent de Paul. I've been on the board of Catholic Community Services. I helped start Habitat for Humanity, which was denied funding by HUD at one point. The city tried to donate a lot to Habitat and was denied that. We had to go back and talk to HUD, to Department of Housing, and they said, well, we haven't granted them the separation yet. They finally did. There's nothing new in my life experience about faith-based organizations, nothing at all. This bill, I think, intermingles in many ways the workings of the department with sometimes the workings of the faith-based organization or the church in a new kind of way, which is not bad. I think it does raise questions about the intermingling that need to be examined and followed, and I see the report. Somewhat like performance measures that you are, I don't equate them with performance measures, but we'd like to know how you're doing. We'd like to know what progress is being made. We'd like to have quantitative and qualitative data, if possible, submit it, and I think that, like performance measures, the report will evolve each time it's made. I'm sure that whoever looks at it or receives the report will have some suggestions about how to improve it. This is too good of a program not to proceed with. I don't see the downside as being something that it's not a major hurdle. It's something that we simply have to be aware of, and it does raise some some questions in the minds of people. I'm supportive of it. I think it's a good program. I would like to see it. It's a seed that's been planted that's just beginning to grow, so we won't see the fruits, so to speak, for a couple more years, and at that time I guess we will have some definitive answers. So I personally like the program, and I certainly would like to see it succeed, and I do look forward to something in writing before the end of the biennium that if we're still here, we will look at it. If we're not here, I guess an interim committee will look at it.
We'll probably still be here.
We may take a brief break and come back in a month or two after that. Did you finish making your...
No, I'm ready to make a motion now, Mr. Chair.
If you would.
Mr. Chair, I move to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 818, subject to approval of the Senate President, and move Senate Bill 818 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves the Senate Bill 818 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, rescinding the referral to Ways and Means at the pleasure of the President, and to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Okay, with that, would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Westbrook?
Excuse?
Senator Montesanto?
Excuse.
Senator Charles Starr?
Aye.
Chair Morrison?
Aye. Thank you. The bill passes to the floor
with a carrier right there.
Pass recommendation, and Senator Shields will carry the bill. And we will close.
If you can do it very calmly, Senator.
I will do it calmly. I promise you.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Senate Bill 666. We'll open the public hearing. Okay, you want to read the summary?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 666, we've heard a couple times. You do have the dash two amendments with your packet, and this basically are amendments from the bill proponents and replaces the bill. What the dash two do is it does define a number of terms used in the bill, including therapeutic interchange, which is one of the key terms. Basically allows an exchange of therapeutic alternates between by a pharmacist, only with the approval of the prescribing physician. It does allow this pharmacist to make those therapeutic interchanges with a written consent of the prescriber, who can then revoke this consent anytime in writing or orally. Does require the pharmacist to notify the prescriber when about the specific dose and prescribed drug that's been exchanged within 24 hours of making the exchange. Does also require that signs in pharmacies include language about substituted drugs having the same therapeutic effect. Prohibits pharmacists from engaging in therapeutic exchanges unless that cost is lower or the same as the drug they're exchanging for. And then does establish that the prescriber is immune from civil liability for injuries that result from the pharmacist's actions when in this therapeutic interchange. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Tom Holt.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Here to speak to the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 666. And just to kind of refresh your memory on the problem we're trying to solve, there are many occasions when a patient's insurance coverage or their ability to pay doesn't match up well with what a physician has prescribed for that patient's condition, and yet the physician may not have a strong preference of what product to use. And in such cases, the pharmacist then has to contact the physician to get a change made, and that can take some time to get resolved. And when we have delays, it tends to result in less compliance with drug therapy, and that's a problem. So what the bill really does is two things with our amendments. One, it removes a lot of the administrative process around prescriptions for which we know with a fair degree of certainty that the end result is going to be a change made to a different product, and thereby increases access to medications. Rick's done a pretty good job of going through what the amendments do, but I'd like to touch on a couple of key points in what we've done here. If you look at the bottom of page one and top of page two, We define two really important terms, therapeutic alternates and therapeutic interchange. Those terms are important. They've been arrived upon by national medical and pharmacy organizations over a period of years of discussion. And that term alternate is really critical because it highlights that there are often equally effective products available in the same drug class. They work in much the same manner from one product to the next, but they are different chemical entities, and so they are often health plans will choose one or the other product from plan to plan. And then the therapeutic interchange is simply the action of choosing an alternate when one is available. So what we're doing here is creating an opt-in voluntary system where a physician could authorize in advance a pharmacist to engage in a therapeutic interchange. There's nothing in these amendments to require a physician to authorize a pharmacist to do this. At the same time, there's nothing to require the pharmacist to engage in an interchange even when authorized to do so. The conditions that we lay out, a few of them are that, one, the pharmacist has to have written, these are on page 2 and through page 3 of the dash 2s, the pharmacist has to have written consent from the prescribing physician for a specific patient. It can't be for just a group of patients. It has to be a specific patient. That could be done a couple of different ways. It could be referring the patient into a protocol that's been developed by the pharmacist and the physician in advance, or it could be simply an indication on the prescription that it's okay to make an interchange per formulary. The consent has to include very specific words, therapeutic interchange allowed, or similar words that clearly indicate the physician's intent, and that has to be documented. And the interchange, again, can take place under a written protocol or per formulary preferred drug list of a health plan. And the product selected then has to be equal or better cost for the payer. And the pharmacist, if the pharmacist engages in an interchange, has to notify the physician that it has taken place so that information can be put into the patient's chart within 24 hours. There are several drug classes that we note that interchange would never be allowed in. Anticonvulsants, antidepressants, antipsychotics, antiretrovirals, chemotherapy, and immunosuppressives. That list more or less mirrors a list of similar to the program we're modeling after in Washington State. The reason for those is those tend to be areas that are a bit touchy in terms of product selection, and it would probably be unlikely that there would be an alternate available in any case. So just to give people comfort around that, we've made that list. Now, one issue remains to be resolved, and that's liability. We have taken a crack at trying to distinguish between physician liability generally and then the pharmacist liability for the interchange, with the language that says a prescribing physician is immune from civil liability for any injuries that result from the actions taken by a pharmacist when a therapeutic interchange is made by the pharmacist is authorized under this section. In other words, the liability for the final interchange decision, which is done by the pharmacist, would lay with the pharmacist. The decisions leading up to that point, the original prescribing decision and so on, would be the physician's liability. Yes, we all
stop right there for just a second. I guess I'm not understanding how, if a doctor says you can go ahead and do this and then you go ahead and do it, somehow he's relieved from liability. That just makes absolutely no sense to
Chair me. Morissette, Senator Cruz, this language would not relieve him from liability for having made the decision to allow interchange. What it would relieve the physician from is those things over which he does not have absolute control, those decisions the pharmacist makes.
It's the doctor's patient, and the drugs are for the patient, and so I don't see how you eliminate that control, even though you've written it into the bill. I think the lawsuit still comes back on the physician.
Yep. Chair Morissette, Senator Cruz, as I was about to say, this language is language that all of us just got earlier today. And I think it's fair to say that, among others, plaintiff's attorneys are not entirely happy with this language, and we're all analyzing it, and there's going to be continuing discussion around this as the bill moves forward through the process.
Well, Mr.
We believe that the issue is resolvable, but we weren't able to resolve it before 3 o'clock this afternoon.
Mr. Chair, I guess ultimately you can say here they can't sue somebody. That's not going to keep them from suing them. And I'm not sure that the courts are going to say that the ability, because we put it in statute, the ability to not sue the doctor is giving that person due process. That was why tort caps were thrown out, because it was denying due process. This follows the same track. So
okay. Okay, we will save the arguments if we have a work session.
As I was saying, we think those issues are resolvable. Some issues are probably not reconcilable, in particular those with our friends in the manufacturing part of the industry. They can speak for themselves, but I would just point out a bit of history that historically, drug manufacturers never have been in support of pharmacists having increased decision-making authority. They also oppose the Washington program that's been in place for now a year with great success. But frankly, the bill, as originally conceived and as we have the amendments, isn't aimed at them. We don't really think that it ultimately affects them. From our standpoint, at least, it looks to us as though the real sale that a pharmaceutical manufacturer makes is to a health plan, to be on their formulary or not be on their formulary. The practitioners are not the fundamental sale, and they're going to win some of those and lose some of those, and I think it will kind of come out in the wash that there may be some plans where they benefit depending on what they've done to get on a formulary and some where they don't benefit. So the policy question really for you is whether you're going to allow the manufacturer to stand between the physician and the pharmacist, who are the two learned professionals who have responsibility for a patient's pharmaceutical care, making sure they get appropriate treatment. In prior testimony, opponents asserted that therapeutic interchange would increase risks to patients. There's just not any evidence of this. Therapeutic interchange has been practiced in non-retail settings for quite some time. It also has, such as hospitals and long-term care, and we also now have the track record from Washington State. And we're hearing from there that it's been quite a success. It's helping patients get better access to medications they can afford. Now, just by passing this, does not mean that every single patient is going to get therapeutic interchange. Besides the classes that we rule out, you know, what we're saying here is that the physician makes a decision patient by patient. If it's appropriate, then the physician can authorize it. If it's not appropriate, then if they don't authorize it, it's end of report. The pharmacist never gets to the point of being able to make that interchange. But even if an interchange is authorized, pharmacists still have a duty to review that and decide for themselves whether it's appropriate based on the information they have. And sometimes pharmacists have information about a patient the physician may not. Pharmacists are not just order-taking robots. They will make judgments themselves about whether it's appropriate for a particular patient and act accordingly. And not all physicians are going to take advantage of this. We think many will see a benefit from it, and we would expect the practice to grow if it was authorized. But it is a voluntary program, again, so we'd like to just kind of get this a start. And just to sum up, what the bill would do now with the Dash 2s is simply provide a tool to make it easier for physicians and pharmacists to manage a patient's drug therapy and make it easier for the patient to receive appropriate, effective, and affordable medication. And with that, our request at this time would be to move forward in the dash two form, understanding that we're going to continue to have discussions around the liability piece when this gets over the other side. With that, I'd be happy to take any other questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Oregon Medical Association. I want to thank Mr. Holt for his diligent work on amending the original bill, and we have endeavored to create a process that would work both for physicians as well as pharmacists. I won't go through my testimony. Most of it is repetitive comments that Mr. Holt has made. I'll focus on Section 13. The language in the bill, Section 13 is a very important part of the legislation in our opinion. As it is currently written, it would still enable personal injury attorney to most certainly file a claim against a physician for authorizing a pharmacist to make a drug substitution or interchange, and if there were co-defendants in a lawsuit, as this is currently written, a pharmacist could suggest in a court of law that it was a physician's responsibility for having allowed authorizing them to make the substitution as well. I think that that particular section does need additional work. In my view, the Lakin decision would not be violated by the current language. It probably, in fact, I'm confident, would not have been violated by the more strict draft language that I had offered previously either. Claimant would still have access to court. They would still have the ability to claim unending damages, which is not what I'm recommending as a good policy for the state of Oregon because of its implications. But we also would agree that the language needs additional work, but we understand that the committee is under time limitations on dealing with Senate bills. If the committee, I'm sure, would like a dissertation about the Lakin decision, the right to jury trial, I'm sure that Alan Tressiger with OTLA would be more than happy to present a summary of the Lakin decision and its implications. Our view of that decision might be a bit different. I'll stop there and answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you. Having spoken briefly to my colleagues individually about where we are in this bill, we do not have enough. We can't pass this bill out today, so we're not going to try. We're just going to let it sit, and we'll see if what happens in the future. But we. Not going to move the bill. Thank you. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 666.
And you want to see what I did while we were at committee?
Yeah. We're going to stand down for just a moment, please. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 782. Mr. Bacovian, would you do a summary, please?
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 782 in your packet. You do have the dash one amendments, including an engrossed version.
After time out, Mr. Hazelwood, would you please sit back there until we call you up, please?
Well, I motioned in, Mr. Chair.
Oh, you did motion.
My fault.
No, the vice chair motioned you, so you may come up and sit down.
Normally, I defer to the chair.
Oh, well, that's okay. Come on up. I just.
In the vice chair.
You've been here so long, I just thought that you were.
I wanted to give him a running start.
Oh, a running start. Very good. I'm sorry for interrupting. Would you please
continue
your summary of the bill?
Thank you, Chair. We did hear this bill a couple times. Current bill requires DHS to maintain records for 24 months of all individuals terminated from public assistance when they lose eligibility due to financial or other situations, and then would direct DHS to inform clients being terminated from programs of when they may be eligible once again. The original bill directs DHS to mail a notice to recipients' last known address to let them know that a change or a program may restore them back to the programs. The Dash 1 Amendments does remove the requirement that DHS maintain records for 24 months, removes the requirement that DHS mail a notice, and then just would require that DHS give notice to a client only on notices that are revised or developed after the effective date of the act, so things that were reprinted or reproduced would simply include some sort of notice. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Would you introduce yourself, please?
Mr. Chair, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I live at Satan, Oregon, a longtime senior advocate. I've been working on a bill similar to this since 1992. It started out as a human impact statement. People being cut out of service, what happened to them? In those early days, there was testimony against it because it had a fiscal impact. And that seems to be stuck in a computer someplace, and normally it comes up as fiscal impact again. So there has been a dash one amendment to it. And feeling a little bit like the coach of the Blazers, you take a victory when you can. There seem very few and far between. And so just as a friendly reminder, if I live long enough, I'll probably be back next session with something similar to a human impact statement. Because in this day and age, the division is getting more and more new computer setups. And so my feeling is still the same as when you're being cut out of service. Somebody needs to know what's happening to these people. I know as a senior advocate, and I've always told people my phone number's in the book, and I get calls all the time, why did I get cut out of service? And I usually say it's a lack of funding. Once nobody told me that, they tell me. And so I say, well, I'll talk to somebody and see, but usually that's the way it winds up. And so now I know lack of funding, that's a truthful statement. But so, Mr. Chair, I would recommend at the present time that we pass this bill to Florida with a due pass recommendation. And I would personally like to thank your staff who's worked diligently on this and put up with me a lot of times.
Okay. Questions?
No.
Okay. This bill, you see this bill as a step toward your ultimate goal.
Yes, sir, I do.
And I guess what I'm interested in is what is currently being done by various agencies that perhaps do keep track and do try to contact people. And I've heard that there are some agencies that do that, some local state agencies that have passed through money. And I guess what I would like to do during the interim is to try to determine if there are some models out there that we could look at for what's already being done to
to use that to build upon. So I think this is a step in that direction, and there is no fiscal impact because we're only asking that notices be put on new mail-outs, nothing, so they don't have to throw anything away, and it's a minimal but important first step, as I see it.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might, this sounds bragging a little bit, but formerly Mid-Willamette Valley Senior Service Agency is now Northwest Senior Disabled, and our AAA has been doing a good job on that, but I can't speak for the rest of them around the state. Okay. We are, without bragging, we're probably number one AAA in the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 782.
Mr. Chair, move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 782.
Which amendment?
Huh?
Which amendment?
Yeah,
you can
move the dash one.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 782. Any objections? Seeing no objections, so move.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 782 to the Senate floor with as amended to the Senate floor to be passed recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 782 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair, please.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Excused.
Senator Montana.
Excused.
Senator Charles Starr.
Aye.
Chair Morrison.
Aye. And I will carry the bill. Okay, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 782 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 870. Would you explain the bill, please?
Thank you, Chair. This bill has also been heard in the past. You have with the packet the dash one amendments, which basically replaces the bill. What the dash ones do is it defines certain terms in the bill. It does establish that Oregon Project Independence, or OPI, is to provide help to eligible clients when they can no longer take care of themselves, provides public information, long-term care planning, and information case management for a fee to those otherwise who would be eligible otherwise for services, if not for resources. It does require appropriated funds for OPI, include crisis services, respite, special needs allowance, education, and other services. Allows a person with disabilities to be eligible for OPI and appropriates general fund to the program in 2005. It does repeal a separate fund account for people over age 60 and those with Alzheimer's disease, and this does have a substantive referral to Ways and Means. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Mary Lee Fay, would you come up, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Mary Lee Fay. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities Program. And thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 870. I believe in previous hearings you've heard about Oregon Project Independence and the important role it has played in our service system, allowing individuals over age 60 who have need of in-home care and want to stay in their home in their home community but don't qualify for our Medicaid program, either because they have income that is slightly above that level or they have some assets above the level for Medicaid. And that program has been a critical program and one that we've run. What Senate Bill 870 does is makes what we believe are two important changes and changes that we would support at the department. The first change it does is it includes people with disabilities under age 60 to also qualify for this program. When Oregon Project Independence first started in 1975, it really predated any Medicaid program that we were able to use in the community. And it really was looking at not accessing nursing homes for seniors. Over the years, Oregon has been able to support not only people over age 60, but people under 60 with disabilities who really have the same needs of staying in their community and not being in a nursing home. And so our Medicaid program really does outreach to both of those populations. What this bill is doing is saying for those individuals who would be in the same situation, who have income or assets that just are slightly out of reach of Medicaid, that they too can have some case management activities and in-home support that allow them to stay in their homes, not spend down, not become Medicaid eligible, and have then the full responsibility of the state and federal government supporting them. So we think that's a very important change. The second change that it does really, I believe, starts positioning us to look at the bigger demographic changes that Oregon and the nation will be facing, and allows the programs to do a lot more outreach and information to individuals in terms of information about long-term care health insurance, about planning for retirement, things that we should be doing that really have people thinking early on about how to manage resources so that they don't become dependent on a Medicaid or a full publicly funded program, and that it allows the case managers in the area agencies on aging who really have developed quite a skill in supporting people to have more access to people looking for support, information, access, resources, and expands that whole development to a larger community. So both of the expansions that are represented in this bill, we think mirrors what we've been doing in the Medicaid program and makes sense for Oregon, and also begins us working on a more sustainable picture on where we're going to be going in the future. So we appreciate your support in this bill, and do know that the department supports the expansion of this bill.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. Lee Hazelwood, would you come up, please? You also got a running start there, Lee, so. Would you identify yourself, please?
Mr. Chair, a member and remaining members of the committee, my name is Lee Hazelwood. I live in Staten, Oregon. I'm a longtime senior advocate, and now I'm adding a disabled advocate to that. I am opposing Bill 870. I go back to 1999 when Oregon Project Independence was $13,730,000. In the present governor's budget, he's taken OPI out altogether. I think in good times, quite a bit of money with the legislature to have this, I might consider this a good bill. But now with limited funding and people being cut off of service or not being added back into because of lack of funding, I cannot support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. And one other comment I might make, there was November, December, there was a summit meeting in Eugene, and to talk about the priority list. This did not come up other than like 5th, 6th, or 7th, and we were supposed to come up with 3 priority lists. This did not make those top 3. And so my comment is back again that in different times and different situations, this might be a good idea, but I cannot support this bill, and I'm sorry to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. Ruth Shepherd, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ruth Shepherd for the record, and I live in Salem. And in 1966, Governor Hatfield appointed me to the first committee to develop all the programs for area agencies on aging. And then in 1972, I came up, living in St. and Eugene at that time, to bring the concept and the detailed concept to interim committee on aging. that became Project Independence. So I have a pretty good long-span interest in this, and I have been in the agency, and I've been a consultant to legislative committees since then in regard to long-term care. And mostly I try to be a positive nuisance. And helpful. I strongly support the major thrusts of 870. And it's something that it gets into territory that may be the saving grace of the system, and that is the case management offering in addition to what we've been doing. I do have a couple of questions, if I may. On lines 10 and 11 on page 1, the question, it puts in, whereas Oregon's long-term care system must be designed to be less dependent on publicly funded programs. I'm not quite willing to throw in the towel that soon. I just think we have to find solutions for the reality that we do have a tendency to grow old, and the state may have some responsibility there continuing over the long term. I don't suggest an amendment. I'm just making a comment about the possibility that the sponsors of the bill might think about this. And then on lines 11 and 12, it describes the public information, on the second page, it describes the plan for a public information program, which I think is a jewel. But I do have a question. I don't see anything in there that guides me over the total numbers of dollars that will be appropriated eventually from different parts of the world for Project Independence. What are the percentages of those dollars that we could expect to go to maintain the care that's provided now in units of service called Oregon Project Independence In-Home and Personal Care? That would be one component. Another component would be the case management one. And the relation, how much is case management going to be as a picture of the, as part of the total picture? And is there a limit? Is there a lid on either one or the other in terms of developing a new program? And I'm sure that that can be worked out, but I don't want to put my questions on record. And I do strongly support this program.
Do you strongly support this bill?
I strongly support this bill, and hope that those particulars that I pointed out today, mm-hmm. for the record, are things that we can deal with.
Thank you. Jacqueline Zimmer, would you come up, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jacqueline Zimmer with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and I'm just here in case there are any questions you have about the bill today.
Questions? Let's move it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
No questions. Okay, we will close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 870.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 870.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 870. Yes, Charles, Senator Starr, please.
I notice there's a blank in Section 6 of the Dash 1. Does that mean that this is going to Ways and Means?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you. That answers my question.
Okay. No objections. Hearing no objections. So moved.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 870 as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 870. Senator Cruz, I'm sorry.
We're interchangeable.
You're interchangeable. I was thinking ahead. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 870 as amendment to Ways and Means of the due pass recommendation. Now, discussion. Did you have anything?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd just say, you know, I've supported this program since 97 when I was first in the building. I think this is a logical expansion. I think it's appropriate to have, you know, there are questions asked about where the money's coming from, that's a discussion that will happen in Ways and Means. So hopefully this puts it at the table, and they can make that determination as they're making allocations.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion? I'd like to say that I too support the expansion, and I may have said this before, but I did serve on an interim task force of senior disabled, and the concern by the disabled community is that they were not being included in a lot of the discussion, at least, and some of the programs, and I saw this as an opportunity to include them. Secondly, I want to thank Ruth Shepherd for her support and graciousness. She had a conceptual amendment which I entertained briefly. I think we might have another, even a priority bill that could address the issue that she wanted to address, and I'm willing to work with her during this session, during these next few weeks, the next few days even, to see if we can draft a priority bill that would address, and it does obviously have to do with OPI, and it's a, I think it's a good idea, but rather than slow down this bill, which we've worked very hard on to get it to this point, I was thinking it would be better to separate it, so we will work together on that. So. Okay. Thank you. Senator Stark.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I do certainly support the expansion. I think it's the right thing to do. But I think it's also necessary that we add our voice of concern to the issue of funding, that this is a program that deserves our support, and we should see some substantial dollars dedicated to Project Independence when we fashion a final budget.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Metzger?
Excused.
Senator Montanus?
Oh. Excused. Thank you.
Senator Charles Starr?
Aye.
Senator Morrison?
Aye. And I will carry the bill.
That's going to Ways and Means.
It's going to Ways and Means, but I would carry it if I could.
Okay.
And we've closed the public hearing, and we will close the work session and close the committee hearing. Thank you. It is going to Ways.